Welcome to Just Another Wine Podcast.
With me, Jamie Good.
Me, Doug Regg.
And me, Emily Harmon.
What's the topic today, guys?
I think the price is right or the price is wrong.
Let's have a discussion
on
the price of wine. Oh, that has a nice ring to it. So, you know, when I first started buying wine, this is maybe the mid-90s. So I remember my first, when I first started buying wine, it was probably about 1992, 93. And the first multiple bottle purchase I made was three bottles of the Brokenwood Graveyard Hermitage 1991. Mm. And that was £13.49 a bottle. I remember that Penfold's Bin 389 was, I think, £11.99 a bottle. And Penfold's Grange was £35 a bottle. And I thought that was too expensive. I won't buy any of that. and then Lindemann's Bin 65 Chardonnay was £4.99 a bottle. And fast forward to today, there's just a few examples. I was kind of started off drinking Australian wine. And today, you know, that the Brokenwood would probably be about £85 a bottle. The Grange is, what, £600 a bottle? And the Bin 389 is 50-something a bottle. And the Lindemann's Bin 65 Chardonnay is £5.99 a bottle. So it's kind of gone up a pound. Everything else has gone up a lot. But generally speaking...
Kind of scary that it's only gone up a pound since the 90s. Because of what the hell?
So we're seeing... And actually, I remember the Montana Sauvignon Blanc. When yep. buying that, £5.99 a bottle. Now it's probably... You can probably buy the equivalent... you know, Sauvignons from Marlborough for £8.50, £9, because they kind of promote them regularly. So some wines have got really expensive. Some wines haven't really moved with inflation. And so cheap wine is cheap and unsustainably cheap, perhaps. But a lot of wines are kind of like to the point where I can't buy them anymore.
We did a podcast on cult wines and icon wines, and I was a somm at a restaurant in South Ken, and we had a vertical of Penfolds. We had three vintages anyway. Grange, 80, 81, 82. £60 a bottle. We had Margaux, 80, 55, I think. £120 a bottle. I don't even think what these wines would cost now. And I would decant the wines as a sommelier and try them to see whether they were in adequate condition.
Good, Nick. Yeah.
And they were phenomenal wines, you know, and I'm not sure the winemaking has improved or the wines are any greater now, but they're more in demand than they've ever been, and that I think command these ridiculous prices that you pay. I say ridiculous because, you know, maybe they are wonderful and worthy, but if they're out of the beyond the pocket of so many ordinary people who never try them in their whole lives, because why would you commit to something like that? What is the point of wine if it's going to be like a bagatelle like that? Just something that you sort of like look at from a distance and, you know, you hear about, you read about, but you never get to try. That's disregarding something that we should probably come to you, Emily, about is markups in restaurants having changed since I was in restaurants, that the average markup was 2.5 times those days. And now I open a wine list and nothing is under three figures practically. And the average markup is probably 4 times in most places. And it's unremitting as well. There's no sort of like gradation for more expensive wines, which to bring them, you know, into the remit of the customer, it's just relentless gross profit margin applied across the whole wine list, making wine much more expensive to buy, perhaps making people drink less because they can't afford to drink more. What would you say about that as someone who works with restaurants?
Yeah, I think there's a number of factors. I think the GP, the gross profit margin, is crazy, like particularly in London. And it is a minimum of 4 times, like you said, to get to that 70% gross profit margin.
So it's 4 times what the restaurant pays for the wine.
Yeah, minimum. And then if you are dealing with anybody who's a hotel, it's much higher than that. It could be 5 times. And you're right, like, it's not staggered. I think there are exceptions. Like, I mean, Noble Rot still, they do maintain good pricing where there is a sliding scale that you can still drink, let's say, premium, fine or rare wines at good prices, because that's their business model and their priority. And it's one of the few places where I actually really want to spend my money on wine because I know I'm getting a reasonable price. I definitely feel that the price of wine impacts me personally. I love drinking great wine, but if I feel I'm being ripped off, I'm like, I'll just drink the cheapest wine on the list then, because you're just flogging me for it. And I think that's one thing. Then there's also regions or producers that have had a lot of attention that have then that sort of escalated demand. I mean, the Jura is an amazing example of that. I mean, all three of us love that region and the wines from there. I remember when I was buying wine at Bistro Bruno Loubet in 2012, 13, and I think a bit of 14. I was pouring Cuvée Florine from Ganavel by the glass for almost 24 months. I was the only person pouring that wine by the glass in London, maybe with the exception of terroirs at the time. But there was no challenge in supply, and we could pour it for £10 a glass consistently.
Oof.
Right?
Yeah.
And now it's like... That's just not even feasible. Like, double that, it's not even feasible. Yeah. And maybe I get three bottles of it,
yeah.
Right? So there's like, one, there's that. I mean, the same thing's happened with Burgundy. So we're seeing, one, increases, many factors. We can all talk about what they are, of why that's caused that. But there's like, I don't know, there's a lot of things that are unraveling with that. I mean, the UK, I think this conversation cannot go without the government imposing these crazy increases on beverage tax that's just happening every year, like the most recent increase. It's just making it even more complicated.
Well, I think the raw cost, I mean, there's so many things to factor in. The raw costs of wine have increased, labour increase. Climate chaos. You talk about Jura wine. Yeah, we used to get, like, I remember, we used to get a pallet of Trousseau from Ganava. Now we get like 24 bottles in a good year, you know. So it's so supply and demand. Remember, the UK was primary market in the early days for so many of these producers, so there was like more wine. But as soon as like other powerful markets like the Far East, particularly in America, came on board, that drove the price of wine up. It became like an auction. Meanwhile, the factors on restaurants, rent rates, wage costs, and just all other costs,
and general tax on alcohol and general UK, tax on for example,
so much so that, let's see if we can do a little equation, maybe Jamie. A bottle of wine which costs, let's say, €5 would be on a restaurant list for, I reckon, around £55 to £60. But you're only getting €5 of wine, but you the middle, you know, the wine merchants buying it, putting their margin on, and then the restaurants putting their whatever 80% GP on top of that. It's still a €5 wine, and €5 doesn't buy you a heck of a lot, I'm afraid. Anymore.
You see, I'm a geek, right? And what I've noticed is that sometimes if you're a geek, you like certain wines. And I remember one example, because I had it in a restaurant last Thursday, I think it was, went to the Draper's Arms. And I found this wine on the restaurant list. And this is a wine that I bought before for like £30.
What was it?
The Vina Tondonia Rosé.
That's an amazing example
of a wine becoming so suddenly so sought after and made in relatively small amounts. I bought it in the past. And I bought it once. I had to buy 6 of the Red Reserva to get one bottle of the Rosé. And so I'm in Draper's Arms, and it's a fantastic wine list there.
And really well priced.
Yeah. And I see the Tondonia Rosé, and,
how much?
£110.
That's okay, actually. That's a fair price, considering how much he's paying for it.
If you get it at retail, so like in Hedonism had some, it was like £90, right?
Yeah.
So it's just really hard to find. And I think it's a brilliant wine. It's a complicated wine, but it's brilliant. And funnily enough, I had one the week before. I found it on the list in the Wynn Palace in Macau in one of the bars. And there was, I think, £140 equivalent. So I bought one there to share with the people I was with. But you rarely see these wines now. So it's almost like a wine you have to give up on. Because it's like, do you know what? Everyone's so interested in getting hold of these wines. You just can't get them. And if you can, they're kind of, the price just creeps up to the place of pain.
Tondonia White used to buy for Grain Store when it opened, and it was about £19 a bottle. So we had it on, I think, for £78 a bottle.
Which is brilliant.
On
the wine list.
There were, like, honestly, it was like there was no limitation on buying it. It was just like, buy as much as you want. Like, it was on the wine list for a year and a half. Again, like, a period of time, because I was just like, that's a wine at that style that's like irreplicable, right? Like, because it's such an individual wine, but it is. It's crazy now that they've done. Maybe they were always underpriced. Like, we can also challenge that. Like, maybe that some of these wines were too cheap, like, as well.
Or
Emilio Pepe, another example.
That's gone up a bit, hasn't it?
Doubled.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is what we get to the point where actually this is where you have to use your geekiness and find things that are really delicious and fantastic, but haven't yet been discovered. So they're still selling at a reasonable price. And I think there's lots of wines like this. It's just you've got to have the confidence in your palate to know that you can really enjoy it. And I think some people, they need to have, the wine needs to be sought after for them to really enjoy it. They need the reassurance that everyone else thinks this is amazing. But I think you get to a stage in your drinking where your palate is at the point where you can be satisfied that this wine you're drinking is fantastic. It doesn't matter if you've never heard, anyone, any press about it, or you don't know it's in demand. And that's when you can find other things, I think, that can replace the super expensive stuff.
But don't you think that wine should be democratized as well? I mean, I want to be able to try some of these, like, wines you're talking about, and would never have the opportunity to. So, like, I think wine lists are really strangely structured. When they apply one margin fits all, so whether it's the cheapest wine or the more expensive wine, it's unrelenting. Whereas,
should a restaurant make £300 off a bottle of wine just because the cost price is X amount, for example? Is it reasonable? That's the question.
Restaurants bank cash, like, it's no point having a wine which is so far beyond everyone's pocket that it just sits on the list. So you can sell that wine, an expensive wine or a premium wine, much more quickly by bringing it down to a much more reasonable price with a cash margin, and everyone will perceive that wine list is really good value. Whether it is or not, you made a statement. You can make your margin, your gross profit margin, if you like, on the cheap wines to incentivize people to drink up the list and more interesting. But at the moment, speaking as a wine merchant, we are seeing more and more of our trade customers defaulting to the cheapest wines they can possibly buy so they can make the biggest gross profit to satisfy the bean counters who are basically targets.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said this, because I 100% share the same point of view in terms of the ideal pricing structure model. And then secondary to that is this idea now that everybody goes, oh, well, guests are not spending that much. And it's like, well, rather than, like, nobody does the reflection work of, like, maybe I need to look at my margins to make it more appetizing. Instead, it's just like, oh, the same price, people only spend wines under 50. Okay, so then you're offering a worse product at the same price because of inflation, because of the tax rate. Like, what's your point of view and what's your perspective on your wine list? Because I really think it's important to not drop quality. Like, where can you actually allow some flexibility with pricing so that you still bring great wine to people? And maybe it means sometimes, okay, the profit margin needs to look a little bit different. And I think there are still wines you can make amazing profit on, like you've said, but equally, like, what do we do? Do we just keep moving a lot of these other wines into the pockets of just private collectors? Like, how do we actually make those wines? And I think we're the kind of movers and shakers of this, as buyers and as sellers, of, like, how do we actually inspire people to be able to still access these wines? And I think you're right, that piece around emerging regions, indigenous varietals, lesser known places, the local stories of those people is really important now more than ever, for a number of reasons, not just from an economic point of view, but also
the restaurants that communicate on wine are the ones that sell it best as well. They're the ones that can discover the new producers for their customers. The restaurants that treat their customers as basically, feeding them money back are the ones who are taking, like, a cynical view that wine is just a commodity and it's to make margin on. Whereas I think we know that from our experience, restaurants that we go to, they're really busy and people are drinking really good wines in them because they're not being treated as cattle.
And I think people have a sense of whether this wine list is something they want to spend their money on. And I know that very quickly. I go to a restaurant, I look at the wine list and say, I'm not buying wine here. This is like, this is a ridiculous list. It's not interesting. The producers are boring and the pricing is insane. But like what the Draper's Arms last week, I spent I'm not a rich person, but I spent £190 on wine because we had the Tondonia and then they had the Sylvain Petit Aligoté. And so it's like, wow. So why I felt not? A bit greedy, yeah. But it was kind of like special evening. And it was just beautiful.
But also, if you get a bargain, I think you told me about Levan. I think you did. You have a Auvernois there.
Yes.
Yeah, Poussin or something like that. Yeah, yeah. And it was incredibly well priced.
That was with Christina. Yeah, we went there. And they've got it's like
10 cases in another place. Like, there's a number of places that are like, we can make it reasonable.
And we tell other people in the trade who tell other people, and it becomes this viral thing about go to so and so if you want to drink the most amazing wines at an uncynical price. And I think this is why these places churn through wines, because they've got the right philosophy.
The funniest was Brilliant Corners, though, that they had a 10th anniversary wine list for a while, and basically all their rares, I don't think they realised what they'd got, were put on a basically below retail price on a little short list. And so I went in there, it was like, it happened to be my birthday to coincide, so we went and basically raided this list.
We all need to go there together, I think.
And I remember the best one was a whole group of us. It was a Beaujolais event. I don't know, were you there? I don't know. It was a Beaujolais event. I was with a reasonable sized group. I think it was the... and basically we got hold of the terroir's sort of like friends and family list of all the rares on it. And this is before the pricing had been adjusted to reflect the increased demand for these wines, and we just tucked in. But that's naughty behaviour, I think. But it also shows that people get excited. If you've got something that's good and your pricing is fair, I think people will make use of that.
I also think that, you know, now everyone spends most of their time Googling pricing, which is crazy, but it's something that didn't people happen when we started working as SOMs. But I think, you know, like I know someone very well who said, oh, my wine is, I've got this wine £30 or £40 cheaper than this place, and I thought this place was supposed to be good value. Should I put the prices up? And I said, no. I mean, like, you know, like, make hay. Like, advertise the fact. It may annoy other accounts, but you have your own model, your own business model of what you want to make on wine. If you're just making a cash margin, then just do it. And maybe, hopefully, other accounts will take notice of it, because no one wants to be perceived as super expensive. So it just needs, you know, the first person to stick their head above the parapet and say, I'm not like doing these crazy margins anymore. I just want to sell wine, you know.
I'd like to add a point on this, because I think there's the one thing of like the business model idea, right? And we can all go, oh, it'd be amazing if everybody just does that, like sliding margin. So like the percentage goes down as the cost of the wine goes up. Perfect, ideal. But then there's those people that also have those business models, but then they get that rare wine. We talked about this on the Miroir episode, right? Like when we did talked about icons and cult wines. And then there's that person that gets that bottle of wine that pays like normal trade price from you, for example, Doug. Let's just use the Miroir example. And then they put it on their wine list and then they mark it up to like 300-400. And that irritates the shit out of me, because it's like, and I'm sorry to swear, but like it really does, because it's like, you haven't paid an escalated price. Why are you contributing to escalating that price? And that, I think, is not cool. And I think that is where I would really like there to be, like, there should be kind of almost like wine trade ethics of like, for me, it's just like, that's an unspoken agreement that if I purchase that wine, I'm not going to participate in that system of escalating the price for others.
That's why these indexes, like, you know, Bordeaux Index, I'm not talking about the company, I'm just talking about the idea that there's a price out there, an auction price for a whole bunch of wines, Bordeaux, Rhone, Tuscan, whatever. I think when we were talking about Miroir, it comes back to, I think when we were just about to close Terroir, that we gave them a lot of Miroir to sell. And I said, like, specifically, I want you to sell it by the glass, you know, £15 a glass or whatever it is. I want as many people to try this wine as possible. You're not going to make money out of it. It's, you know, make a little bit of money, but that's not really the point. It's what a great opportunity. And they did. And the people just came. The restaurant, which had not been that busy, was suddenly really busy with wine nerds and other people, really enjoying this opportunity. Because if you're going to buy a bottle of that, are you just going to drink it by yourself with no friends? Or are you going to, like, share it? Of course you want to share it. So I think increasingly with the sort of rare wines, they are going to be rationed, but we hope that restaurants particularly are creative in the way that they bring that wine to as many people as possible. I think that'll be a really generous gesture. And you're not going to sell a wine for like £100 a glass either. No. I hope not.
I think it's really good that some places have a policy, which is that you can only, you have to drink in.
Yes.
This wine has to be drunk in. So people don't come in, see a rare, and then just walk out with it.
Yeah.
You told us, did you tell us about Farmyard? Shall I? Was it Farmyard you went to?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was really cool. So yeah. What happened there is they just got their allocation of Ganava, and it was on the top shelf somewhere, and I spotted it and I said, oh, is that for sale? Any of those bottles for sale? And the guy said, oh, I've got to phone my wife to find out. And the news was that, yes, you can buy one bottle, but you must drink it in here. And I said, yeah, well, so I chose the one I wanted. I can't remember which one we chose, but it was like, felt really special. Then I was waiting for the shock of the price, because I think, I know it's like at some places this would be 250, you know, and it was like £100. It's like, that's really very reasonable. That's a cash margin.
Mm.
And so that was a nice experience, you know.
Mm-hmm. I like that story. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Good people, you know, and I love that restaurant. It's so good. Right,
well,
so
now we're basically, having talked about, like, expensive wines again, because we always end up talking about expensive wines, let's talk about, like, discoveries. Yeah, things that could command a reasonable price, but, you know, we enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not about, like, whether you enjoy a fifth of the amount or a tenth of the amount or half the amount. It's just, like, we enjoy, and they intrigue us, and we like talking about them, and, yeah. I wanted to bring this because I haven't tried it myself yet, and we just received it last week.
So for the benefit of the tape, this is Thierry Navarre 2023 Liniers
from Saint-Chinian.
So it's a Vin de France, but it comes from Saint-Chinian, so in the Languedoc, and it's 13% alcohol. Doug, what else can you tell us about this?
So Thierry Navarre is engaged in reviving grape varieties that were extant in the 18th and 19th centuries in the Languedoc. And they pretty well died out, but there was like a small nursery that had some grape varieties that he took cuttings from. And he, noticeably for his red, he worked with a grape variety called Iard, which is a relation of Sanso, and also Ribéranc Noir, which is very rare. And his contention is that this is what normal people drank in the Languedoc. You know, they didn't drink Shiraz or Grenache. These grape varieties weren't around then. They didn't drink alcoholic wines. They drank wines which were sort of 10.5%, 11.5%.
And the wine that we're trying now is a white.
It's a white,
yep.
Made from two grape varieties you'll know and one grape variety you may not know. So the grape variety you might know is Grenache Gris.
Mm.
And that gives, Grenache Gris has got some real body and punch. Yeah. It's quite a punchy grape variety. Clairette Blanche.
Okay, I thought it was Clairette because the acidity and, line in there.
Yeah, and that provides some acidity. And Ribéranc, no, Blanc.
Ribéranc Blanc.
This and I didn't know this existed because you can probably Wikipedia and there might be like a half a line on it. But it, again, it's one of these incredibly rare grape varieties. There's a Ribéranc Noir Blanc and I think there's a Gris as well. But only someone like Thierry would like stick it in.
And what price would this be?
So this would be retail around 23, 20-ish, I guess.
Yeah. So this is the thing. This is about finding these wines. So this is quite profound. I love this. And the Languedoc, especially, this, even if you're making amazing stuff in the Languedoc, pricing, unless you're the one of the three most famous producers there, the pricing is still quite reasonable.
It I think is very
some things have kind of, again, done this out-of-sight thing, like Grange de Paire. He used to be able to buy that relatively affordably from La Vigneron, Liz and Mike Berry, in the early 90s.
I remember.
but now it's fancy collector's wine. But there's a lot of stuff there that's really very... I love this wine. It's
It's also like, when you think about it, white wines are not so fashionable in the Languedoc Roussillon, but it's intriguing because, we love Burgundy, we love Jura, we love cool climate wines. What about in warm climates now, global climate catastrophe, green white grapes is actually quite an interesting proposition.
Well, yeah, we're seeing this in the Rhone. So in the nicer appellations of the Rhone, in the southern Rhone, white wines are just taking off.
Because I think it's also drinking trends as well, because yeah. I mean, every person that I speak to that's selling wine is like, the demand for white wine is significantly higher than red wine at the moment.
And I think though, the in a warm climate, often whites seem to not suffer as much. Paradoxically, the reds can really suffer. White sometimes seems to get away with it, especially certain varieties. You mentioned Claret. There's like a So it brings a bourbon length, they bring freshness.
They can be more adaptive sometimes. Carignan
Blanc is a really interesting grape variety.
Yes, very. Yeah.
But also looking at Greece, like for example, like there's a lot of places, like for example, even Cyprus, like you've tried a few of the wines, I saw you writing up about.
Yeah, Marikounis, is it?
Marikounis, and also there's another producer that's doing some interesting stuff there, but they work with a varietal called Zinasteri, and it's like Cyprus is one of the hottest parts of Greece, if you consider it as Greece, because I know it's got its own identity, but I mean, the fact that it's still 30 degrees in late October in Cyprus, but you can produce natural levels of alcohol in a white varietal called Zinasteri at like 11.5-12 degrees.
That's kind of cool.
Because it's adapted to the climate.
That's a great variety that should be planted in more places, I mean, so
might
yeah.
need to be in the future.
Doug, this is a really lovely wine. It's got depth. And real depth of flavour. It's not like it's not just pick early, get to 13% alcohol, pick early, and end up with a compressed wine without flavour. This has got an expansive, sort of broad flavour.
It smells a bit like a sake, a bit like a Daiginjo sake, sort of like this green apple laces and like white florals and like peachy pear kind of note to it.
Well, I always think the wines from this region are a bit, they're quite aromatic in it, like vermouth, they have that sort of noir de pain, sort of like. And a textural sort of fennel-y, there's a lot of Garrigue sort of elements in it. But what I like about wines like this, I love texture in wines, and I like the fact that this is a blend of three grapes, and each of them are pulling their weight, You can, as you say, you've got the acidity from the Claret, and you've got the lightness and brightness from the Riberanque, and you've got the...
Grenache.
Yeah, Grenache supplying some muscle.
What's a typical Riberanque like, Doug?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody knows, so I can say anything and people will believe me.
We'll call Thierry Neval when it comes up on the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire question.
Yeah. It's 50-50 or 33-33.
Phone a friend.
Oh, Thierry, mate, we've tried your wine. Want to know what Riberanque tastes like, mate? Yeah. What's it taste like?
Nice.
Yeah, beautiful wine, and this is what we have to look for now, is for wines that we can drink, wines that we can sell. It's people who are making these wines that have become newly famous were still making a living before the wines went to crazy prices. It's like these people, it's looking out for the less fashionable regions is a really important thing.
Yeah, well, let's reframe it almost as like emerging regions. Yeah. And also, like for me, what's really interesting about this, not just price point, is like, because my import business focuses on lesser known regions, which makes it quite difficult to sell the wine sometimes. But I think the storytelling is way more interesting. Like these great varieties that you haven't tasted, these flavours you haven't experienced before, like the history of that place is really intriguing, that you actually get like a 360 degrees experience of something new.
I like the idea there's no reference point, so you have to find your own reference points. Similar in certain respects, and perhaps it does make us feel of the Languedoc, sunshine, rock and Garrigue and like Saint-Julien and whatever, if we've been there. But that's not really the point. The point is like it really delivers flavour, in the glass. And, it's like it's a wine you just like, come back to. I have to say some more famous growers are also like they're conscious that they have they make trophy wines, and they try to also, for their sense of honour almost, trying to make wines at a much lower price level.
Yeah.
So you'll see a lot of tiers of wine. And the wines at a lower price level are not inconsiderable, you know, in comparison. It's not that they're just cheaper and they're worse. It's they're really interesting because it comes from the same place and the same person. Ultimately, it, maybe it's younger vines, or maybe it's, you know, in tank rather than in 100% new wood. Who knows? But there are ways of finding inexpensive wines out there.
But also, I do think the world does need good, cheap wine. I think maybe some of the problems the wine world is experiencing at the moment are because some of the stuff at the bottom end of the market is not really a good advert for wine.
No.
And I would love, if I was making wine, I would love to be able to, you know, through, you know, getting decent yields, because yields are money. So getting decent yields, farming well, farming in a, you know, really nice sort of like sensitive, regenerative way, but getting decent yields of grapes from varieties that crop well, but also, and then making sort of lighter wines that are honest and natural and pure, but selling them at decent prices, I think it would be the absolute goal.
Yeah, I mean, the tricky thing is, like, that's not wines that can be made everywhere, right? Like, because of the varietal, because of the weather conditions
you need to go somewhere sunny.
Yeah, like South America, maybe Sicily the moment. Like, I mean, you have wines.
I think it's a really good goal to make wines that people can afford. The other thing I think is that when you get to a region like the Languedoc, it's people that are making wines and they can get these. This is a good price for a Languedoc wine. You know, most Languedoc wines are sold very cheaply. I think maybe the fact that some people have become very expensive has created some, you know, that it's created a bit of space for other people to make a little bit more money out of their wines.
Mm.
And I think that's a positive trajectory. So they're making affordable wine. They're making affordable wine profitably, because the fancy things have got so expensive. It's changed people's expectations about how much they'll pay for a bottle from that region. So you look at the fact that red Burgundy, or Bourgogne, as we should call it, has got so expensive. Maybe that's opened the door for Pinot Noirs from other places.
Which is very convenient, considering the bottle of wine you're about to pop open.
What are you doing, Jamie, there?
No, what have you got under the table?
This wine, I think, is a good example of what I would call a fine wine, but at a price that I can afford on a normal professional salary. And the wine in question is Hannes Storm's Pinot Noir 2018 Ignis from Upper Hemelnard Valley. And it's 2018 vintage, so it's got a few years on it. But these are wines I can afford to buy. And I think, you know, in terms of Pinot Noir, I think there's a few regions now making some fantastic Pinot Noirs that are still within reach of normal people. And I think that's fantastic.
I mean, also from South Africa, Cristal and Peter Max, for example.
The Cristal, I think, is
excellent wine.
Peter Allen Finlayson is making some astonishingly beautiful wines.
It's a perception of the region, because I mean, look at Oregon. Bless Oregon, we love it, and we love the Pinots. But those are still prices, because their target market is California, domestic market, and people pay any money because they equate Pinot Noir as the noble grape of sideways and
Oregon Pinot Noirs, pretty much all of them have got punchy, and by the time they're in the UK, you can't really sell them because they're too expensive. I mean, there's no discount there on red Burgundy. You know, they're priced at the sort of line priced with the village level and above red Burgundies. So
yeah, they compete already with an established image that already exists at that price point. So then it's sometimes challenging in the UK to get people to step into an Oregon wine over a French Pinot. But I think South Africa is quite interesting in that, because there's a lot of wine.
There's a lot of really good fine wine that's affordable, especially in South Africa.
I mean, between 60 and £100 on a wine list, like really good wine that you can find.
So this is not cheap wine, but I think it's a wine that offers real value. It's Upper Hemelnard Valley, and that so often has a distinct savouriness, I think, to the wine, especially, and that's going to be exaggerated by the fact that this is now
7 years old.
7 years old, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, sort of smoky, slightly pruny.
Almost autumnal.
Yes.
Like it makes me think bonfire.
But then there's
smoked tea.
Yeah.
And the palate is not just about sweet fruit. There is some sweet fruit, but then there's this savoury, almost bloody iodine sort of quality. I think that often I find in the Upper Hemelnard Valley, in those wines, it's can be quite grainy and and angular, but in a nice way.
But it's nice because there's still quite a bit of structure there.
Yeah.
Like the tannin structure's there. The acid line is very nicely integrated, but then this interplay between sort of sweet and savoury fruit, it's in a really nice drinking spot.
Yeah, I think I'd drink it now. I'm not going to cellar this for, but obviously I opened it now.
Yeah, it's quite developed, I think, on the palate. And it's not my particular style of Pinot, but I actually really like it because it reminds me of other things. It also it's got a bit of smoky bacon Syrah quality to it, and I love Syrah. So comparing Pinot to Syrah doesn't sort of worry me too much.
Yeah, because cool climate, South Africa is still quite warm by, say, for instance, cool climate France standards. This is plenty of sunshine.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Burgundy's getting pretty warm too, eh? Like, there's been quite a lot of vintages where the wines are, like, 14, 14 and a half, even 15, and some of the, like, Gevry.
Is the problem this idea of ripeness? You know, picking... The idea with red wines, you have to pick at a certain level of ripeness, otherwise they're considered green or unpleasant. With white wines, this is not a problem. You can play around.
I think it's the pursuit of flavour ripeness on the part of the wine grower that leads to trouble when you're in a warm climate with red wines, as you were suggesting. So it's like people are scared of green, and so they're kind of waiting for the flavors in the grapes to kind of like to be more resolved. They want the tannins more resolved. The problem with that is if you're tasting the grapes, and this is my own particular personal view, and you're looking for the flavor ripeness in the grapes, you've missed your pick. And the wines end up high alcohol and just the fruit profile is...
But don't you think this is also comes down to overall business model decisions? Because you can pick somebody making a choice on physiological ripeness, which is what we're talking about right now. That can look very different in terms of the overall structure and, let's say, analysis of the wine, depending on the decision that somebody's made on their method of farming, their method of training, their varietals that they've planted based on that soil, and all those other things. Because, for example, southeastern Sicily is a really good example of that. You're on the parallel with Tunisia. It's extremely hot. There are producers like Kos, Ariana Occhipinti, Agricola V&B, Marabino. So I can say for sure with Marabino and also Agricola V&B, they don't pick early. They're picking in mid to late September all the way through to October. But because they farm biodynamically, they work with bush vines, they train the fruit, really grow to the really low to the ground. They work with they have limestone soils there. Like, this combination means that there's a really slow ripening period. But they're also working with varietals like Nero d'Avola that have high natural acidity. So when they're picking still in late September and they're not cropping high, you get actually wine still at natural acidity levels between 11 and 13 degrees alcohol, but you get acid levels that are similar to Mosel Riesling, but you're basically in Africa, like, in terms of climate. So but they pick on physiological ripeness. So I really think that really sometimes comes down to the farming decisions that can shape that final wine, because maybe sometimes picking on physiological ripeness now with certain varietals in certain regions doesn't make sense anymore. So I just want to throw that into the conversation of what do you think?
I think if you want to pick early, because obviously the trend has been to start picking more early, and you taste some wines where people have picked early and they've kind of like, the wines taste very compressed and just not really in the right place. And I think that the thing is, if you want to pick early, you've got to farm to pick early. I think Evan Sardi, that's one of his phrases. If you want to pick early, farm to pick early. You know, get your farming right. If you want a wine with freshness, it's all in the farming. And I think that's you can't just go in there and just pick while the acidity is still high, because you've got to have those flavour components right. Mm-hmm. I think where I was getting before is just some people's idea of flavour ripeness or physiological ripeness.
It's different.
It's actually overripeness, but they're looking for... So it's a stylistic goal, maybe, you know, because some people do like jammy, rich red wines.
I think a lot of consumers do.
Yeah.
But also I think if you measure sort of sugar ripeness and alcohol, it's very different too if you measure it on your tongue. If you bite into a grape, you think, oh, that's really refreshing. That's me, you know, like, there's a very tactile way of looking at a wine. But if you just wait for ripeness... it's often too late when you do that. I think also the way you profile your own taste as a vineyard. So like Craig Hawkins, for example, he picks on taste. But he's
also notoriously picking early. Like he says, I pick before everybody else. Like
yeah, because he likes acid line in his wine.
Yeah.
Having said that, the way he makes the wine is sort of mellowed the wine out a bit. So, but still, you know, like some people, I like wines which are al dente, you know, which I can buy into, which are crunchy, which are red fruit as well. Thierry Germain, the Loire, red fruit all the way. So many Cabernet Francs are now, you know, verging on black fruit. And he said, like, I associate black with death. You know, it's gone too far. Whereas I like the idea of the sap still in the wine as you're trying it. And so you get that gush of red fruits with Pinot Noir as well. You know, I like the gush of red fruit. I like the sort of floral aspect of it. And it's a very fine line and comes all down to balance and an idea that the grower has in the vineyard, what they're looking for in the final wine. And as a final sort of coda to this little tangent, we work with a grower in Mirovoir. Mirovoir is an incredibly hot, dry region now.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really, really suffering. This is Jean-Baptiste Senna. And they're getting rid of like things like Syrah because it's becoming Shiraz-like and whatever. And they're growing things like Picpoul Noir. Because it ripens at 10.5%, and it's really good in blends. And they're looking for cooler climate, north-facing sites, planting young vines, not aging them as well. The profile is like drinkability, freshness, youthfulness, exuberance. And there are no barrels now in the cellar. It's all cement. And the wines are changing, for me, for the better, because they're much more delicious. But I think so many people went through that sort of spell, going back to the Languedoc, of it's got to be barriques, you know?
But I feel that's a trend globally of like warmer climate producers moving away from oak, realizing that there's already enough concentration and moving more towards cement or stainless steel or maybe
even may be cheaper as well, though, to bring it back. You know, I think, you know, one of the problems is that if you're just fitting out your barrel room with barrels, that's expensive. And and the wine needs time to digest the oak. Yeah. So you need an extra year or two or three to mature it. Whereas if you're just working with cement or tanks or whatever, you can release it early and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's not as expensive. I mean, because you haven't put so much investment in the winery then.
And we do need these nourishing, drinkable wines. And one of the things I'm fascinated by in Portugal is the resurgence of the paliete style of wine, which is the sort of wine that the workers would have drunk, you know.
Vino, like the wine of the contadino, like.
So it's a field blend with lots of white grapes and red grapes all fermented together. It makes lighter red wines that are nourishing at low alcohol levels. And these are fantastic. This is really good.
That's like the Palmento wines, right, from Vino
Diana. Contadina wines of, it's, you know, all those guys. Yeah,
I know. We really do need these. And these wines are delicious and they go to market quickly. It's bringing cash to the producers. It's also, it means they can be a bit cheaper.
Yes.
And so they can reach a bigger market.
It gets back to what wine is all about, though, doesn't it? It should be there to be drunk.
We love our fancy wines, but we also love sharing wines at table that are good and interesting and hold our, you know, we can drink them unconsciously, but we can also, you know, pause and give them some attention and they repay that attention because there's something good and interesting going on with them.
Yeah, and maybe it's also worth just adding that experience for somebody who's in a restaurant and then you get talked into a wine that's beyond your budget and how uncomfortable that feeling is to feel stressed about how much you're spending. And I think that is something that, especially this year, people are feeling more and more. Like, no one wants to be in that situation where you're like, I've spent more than I can afford, and then you don't really relate to the wine, right? Like, how nice is it when you can share wine and you feel comfortable with how much you're spending on it, that it doesn't feel like a complete stretch or that you've been moved so far out of your comfort zone that you can't even then appreciate the wine and share it because you're stressed about the money.
Yeah, because I think wine should be for everyone. I remember when I first started getting interested in wine, we just adopted the boys, you know. Well, actually, it was a bit later we adopted the boys, but we were like, financially, we were a little precarious, and that's why I planted an allotment with vines. So I thought, well, if we can't afford to buy wine, at least I can make some wine from this allotment. maybe it's a scarcity mindset. You know, I was thinking, well, what if we can't afford to buy wine? Maybe if we can make some, we can still drink.
It's a helpful scarcity mindset in that
really,
side.
We really enjoyed drinking wines, and it was a nice part of the evening is to have a glass of wine. And I thought, maybe if we can't afford the wine, because it was, you know, it's the budget was a little stretched on one sort of salary and with two mouths to feed and the attendant expenses, then I thought, well, yeah, we could maybe make some. But I planted these vines on this allotment, and then it got so busy that they just grew and they just formed this forest of vines where they'd kind of grown into each other. It's quite a fertile site as well. And I got a warning from the allotment committee, and then they stole my allotment from me. So it was like too bad. But fortunately, this is like a divine joke. It's like, if you look now, it's like, there's so much wine in this place, it's not going to run out.
Yes.
But I do think that making a wine offering at the bottom end that's not just ultra-processed wines is really interesting, because we talk about ultra-processed food. No one talks about ultra-processed wines. And then there was this move towards the zero-alcohol wines. I kind of like, yeah, I think this is kind of good, but these wines are totally ultra-processed. These are the most processed wines in the world.
And wines you make these processed wines, shipped to there,
and then you do some more processing.
Then you move it somewhere else, and then you bottle it again, and then you sell it.
It's like, and you sell it for like quite a lot of money, even though there's no alcohol in it. It's like, I'm kind of feeling maybe we can do better than this.
Yeah, couldn't we make
a nice drink that we can drink that's not got alcohol in it, that doesn't involve ultra-processed
nonsense. Yeah, mocktails.
Shrubs are amazing.
Fermentations that aren't alcoholic fermentations, herbs, yeah.
Listen, I make kombucha every 2 weeks at home.
Yeah.
It's delicious. Yeah, because you have your own fermentation, it's not alcoholic, and then it's really fun. And of course, everybody can be like, oh, it's not that good for you, but it's way better for you than alcohol. And also, if you make it, then you bottle it, and then you can add different fruits to it.
Why is it not supposed to be good for you?
It's been sold as something that has probiotic benefit, but then it's questioned of it, does it have that much probiotic benefit? Because there's quite a bit of natural sugar in it. But again, it depends on how far you ferment it. So I ferment it till it's dry or close to dry, and then I add fruit syrups. But I add fruit syrups, but sometimes I add like bitters and different things like rose water. And you can make I made this one, and I did like lavender bitters. I did a little bit of rose water, and then I did like a blueberry syrup. It was next level. Like, I did another one, like a passion fruit syrup that I made. Like, the next one, next round, I'm going to do yuzu. Like, you can actually have a lot of fun with this stuff. And also, you can make a lot of these things yourself as well. So it's very, I don't know. For me, I'm very interested in fermentation in general. But
these can be very refreshing drinks. But to get back to wine, we want wine which is maybe not so alcoholic, which is digestible. It's good with a lot of different food.
And which goes back to indigenous varietals.
Yeah, we often want the kick of alcohol, like a mild kick, but not too much. I'm going to throw this in. Is red wine trying to be... too many producers trying to make too impressive red wines when they should be dialing it down and making something more drinkable and better value at the bottom end of the list? It's something I've always thought about. I went to a very famous two-star Michelin restaurant, and the sommelier said, what would you like to drink? And Eric, my business partner, said, oh, well, our palates, we like sort of freshness, purity and sort of deliciousness. And she bought us a 14.5% Collioure, and then he said,
oh, she got the briefing then.
Yeah, got the, can we go the other way? We don't want to be impressed by the wine we went into drinking. Next wine was 15%. And then she was so respectful of our palates wanting the greatest wine she could possibly provide. She went right up the list, and the wines got bigger and bigger and blacker and bolder. And finally Eric said, I think we'll just have a beer.
No.
Yeah. And it was he said, no, look, we'll pay for the wine, and no disrespect to you. You're just trying to do your job, but maybe you didn't.
She served the wine for you already.
Yeah, she poured it out, and we tried it, because she would give us the briefing on the wine and say, it's from this small producer and so and so. But obviously, the wines on that list were built to impress.
Mm.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't, you know, in company, you just want to be there for the food and the company. And you don't want the wine to be the foreground and the be-all and end-all. And you don't want to pay £150 for a bottle of something that you're not really going to enjoy so much. So I sort of agreed with him. And it's happened to me on numerous occasions where I said, less, less, less. Okay, now my palate is ruined because I've got all this tannin in my mouth. This is why I tend to drink white wines or orange wines, because I find the right thing. Whereas red wines, it comes down to balance. If it's beautiful, fine, but it's so difficult to find the wine that totally aligns with my mood that some sommelier isn't trying to push me towards, either because it's more expensive or because it's more impressive.
It's so interesting. I mean, I remember the first time when Eric came to Berlin in 2019, when we did the first wine fair, and he came to the restaurant where I was consulting, and I sort of served him and was like, oh, what wine would you like? And I was so nervous because I was like, I hold this man in such esteem that I was like, fucking also, like, he's tasted so much wine. And then he's like, oh, you just pick something for me. And I'm thinking,
that makes it even more difficult. Yes. that's like the worst thing you can do.
And I was just like, what does he not import? What might he like? And then I'm like, could you, try to ask questions. And he's just like, oh, yeah, whatever. And you're just like, no, don't do that thing of being really nice. And actually, I picked, Korab, the Korab wines from Czechia, from Moravia?
Yeah.
I picked the Saint Laurent from him, which is at like 11.5%. And I was like, this isn't a perfect wine, but I love that about it, and I think they're really pure and they're very authentic. And I was like, maybe he doesn't know it, and he didn't. So I was like, yes. And it was like, but you know, then he was like, and something else, and I was like, oh no, I'm gonna go for the whole process.
But that's the trouble with Eric, is that even if it's by himself, there'll be about like 8 bottles of the
on that note. Yeah. I think we should draw this conversation to a close.
Okay,
it's been a really interesting sort of like journey through looking at the issues of pricing of wine, and there's different levels at which we can address this. One is the cost of which it's expensive to make wine, so making wine has become progressively more expensive. We've got then the channel through which wine gets through to consumers, where the costs have racked up, especially when it comes to restaurants. Recently, we've got higher staff costs, we've got
higher tax rates,
higher energy costs, higher restaurant
costs.
So we've got this perfect storm for wine, where wine naturally is being pushed into a more expensive place. And then the thing is, people generally will drink less wine if it's more expensive. So this is problematic. But then the other side, we go to the geek end, where some of the kind of like the wines that we've really cherished have become famous and sought after, and so they're too expensive now. So we have to look elsewhere to find that same sort of geeky Venus hit. But fortunately, there's no shortage of really interesting wine out there. I think this is a very exciting time to be a wine drinker. You just got to have an open mind and a willingness to
explore the unknown. Explore
the unknown, yes. Mm.
Very well said.
Thank you for tuning in. And you can find us on Instagram if you're not already following us on Instagram. I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Jamie Good.
I'm Doug Gregg.
Cheers.
Cheers.